This is Central Time. The pandemic has changed the way a lot of people think about work. Labor strikes have cropped up in places around the country, and record numbers of people have quit their jobs, with many citing a lack of work-life balance. But how did that balance between work and life in the U.S. get so out of whack in the first place? That's the next question our next guest recently set out to answer. She says a big reason is our glorification of overwork, also known as hustle culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you someone who takes pride in working 50, 60, 70 hours a week? Or are you someone who feels pressured to work 50, 60, 70 hours a week by your workplace? Or do you work hard to preserve a maximum 40-hour work week? Do you think we put too much value in working and working a lot over the course of the week? Or do you think it's a good thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy, the labor market, and the workplace. Aki, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you compare the U.S. with some other countries in your piece. You start out with an interesting perspective. How does hustle culture in Japan compare to the United States?
Sure. So Japan is where I'm from, and Japan famously has a very intense overworking culture, so much so that there is actually a specific word, karoshi, which means death by overwork. But interestingly, for a long time, Japan was considered the most overworked country in the world. Recently, Japan has started working less than Americans, so that itself tells you how bad it's become in America.
You look back at historical trends of how many hours per work on average we work. And going back to 1980, correct me if I'm reading your charts wrong, but in 1980, we look like, if you compare us to like a Germany or a France, we're in the same ballpark. Things have changed a lot since then. What do we look like compared to some of our big industrial peers around the world?
Sure. So if you take the example of Germany, for example, for a very long time, Germans worked more than Americans. But around 1970, 1980, that relationship flipped. Germans started working a lot less. Today, Germans work about 400 hours less than Americans, which works out to about 10 weeks less.
What is driving that in the United States?
I think there are a lot of factors in the story. I talk about the decline in labor unions. I also talk about rising income inequality that made overworking increasingly worthwhile in America. But the thing that I talk about the most in my story is our changing attitudes around work. We might kind of take this hustle culture mentality for granted in America today, but that wasn't always the case. For a long time, work was just work, the thing that you put food on the table for. Increasingly, it became our primary source of meaning and purpose, the way that we change the world. And that rise in, you know, that growing importance of work in American life was what I wanted to write about in my story.
And let's get into that modern hustle culture, because you write in the piece, once upon a time, say in the 1800s, the people working longest were the people who were paid hourly to work in a factory or a mine or what have you. Now, a lot of times, hustle culture, those long, long work weeks, are people at the top of the salary level?
Yeah, exactly. It's such a strange thing, because when you look at the data from around the Industrial Revolution, poor people were the people who worked the most. Rich people were the people who worked the least. And that makes a lot of sense. But today, when you look at the data, rich people are actually the people who work the most. And people with lower income jobs are the people who work the least. It's this very confusing flip that shows you how much, especially white collar professionals, have come to value work.
What is leading to that mindset?
I think it's this idea that work should be, you know, the thing that gives us meaning and purpose in our lives. Any career book that you read, any TED Talk that you listen to, any productivity hack blog that you read tells you that you should work more and more and more, because that's the thing that's going to make you happy. I think it's that real valuing of work and you know, kind of a diminishing of leisure that's what led to the hustle culture that we have today.
Aki Ito is with us. She covers the economy, labor market, and workplace for Business Insider. She's with us today to talk about hustle culture and why some say it's gotten Americans addicted to work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are things like at your workplace? Is there an expectation that people work above and beyond the 40-hour work week? Is there a desire to do that? Do you enjoy your work so much you feel like that you're happy to work extra long work weeks? Or where you work, is everybody working for the weekend? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about how Americans think about work, the idea of hustle culture. Aki Ito is with us from Business Insider. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is the standard at your workplace that you work long hours? That you're available even when you're not working, when you're at home at night, when you're on vacation even? Or is there a strict barrier between work and the rest of your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aki, you write that there's kind of a culture shock sometimes when Americans go to work with, say, Germans and find out that expectation that you're always on the clock isn't there. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. So for my story, I talked to quite a few expats, American expats in Europe, and they told me that one of the things that shocked them the most when they went to Europe was how, fiercely Europeans guard their free time from work. I think, you know, here in America, we're used to hopping on a call at maybe 8 p.m. After we've already logged off, if that's convenient for our managers. But I think that's very rare in Europe because they really value their free time so much more than we value our free time here.
Is there a solution? Do we need a solution? I guess I should start there. Is this a bad thing if some people want to work in places where they're expected to work a lot and be on call? Is that a bad thing?
You know, I think if you asked a lot of Americans that question, maybe 5 years ago, people might have said, no, we don't need a solution for it. That's the way we want to live. But I think during this pandemic, a lot of us, including me, have reconsidered their lives, the role that work should play in their lives. And they've come to think that, they actually do want to work less. They don't want to work the way that they were working before the pandemic. And if a lot of us are thinking that way, I think that calls for collective solutions. It's pretty hard for us to push back individually against our employers, and that requires a big collective action like legislation and that kind of thing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pete is with us in Milwaukee. Pete, hi.
Hello, Rob. Hey, I have a different spin on this. There are many reasons why employers are pushing their employees to work longer hours. I'm a mechanic who wears several hats because I'm driving school buses in the morning and the afternoon. Simply said, there aren't enough school bus drivers available in the market. So nobody wants to drive school buses because you got to get up at 5 or 5:30 at the latest and then go to work. And then you're still not done until nearly 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So I put my 10-hour day in and only 4 hours of it is mechanicking, and the rest of the time is driving school kids around. So that is my spin on this. It's the causes of this are not entirely just employers wanting to force their workers to work harder or wanting to save money.
Pete, thanks a lot for the call. And Aki, you were just talking about some of the impacts of COVID and the changes. And there's Pete. There's a lot of lines at work where we don't have enough people, so we're trying to get the ones we still have, like Pete, to work as much as they can.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting time right now in the U.S. economy because we do have a shortage of workers, which requires the people who are working now to work extra. But at the same time, all these Americans have also come to this realization during the pandemic that they want to work less. So I think you kind of see that clash a lot more about, you know, what they want to do and what they need to do, which makes it a really interesting story.
Well, Pete, thanks for getting our kids back and forth to school. We'll go next to Lisa in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, I was calling specifically to Germany. My husband and I have worked and lived abroad, and in Germany, corporations are fined if they email their employees past work hours to do any work. So they really do protect their employees, and their time off is precious.
Lisa, thanks a lot. Aki, that, I mean, it seems so alien here in the U.S., the notion that a company could be fined, but that's how it works there.
Yeah, yeah. Germany has so many protections for workers. It's also illegal in Germany for an employer to ask an employee to work on a Sunday. If they want to, they have to ask their local government specifically for permission, which is an amazing thing. When you see, I think that's one of the things, it's really hard for individual employees to fight back. But if they have the, you know, these unions and these laws backing them up, it becomes a lot easier to protect your leisure time.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Ryan is on the line in Oostburg. Ryan, hi.
Oh, yes. I was just thinking, you know, what we all have thought of as a work-life balance, and that's the quote-unquote term everybody knows. You know, if you read about Masters of Business and Real-Life Business, Jack Welch and his wife authored, talking about a work-life ratio and how it's each person's, you know, their individual choice and prerogative and what they're comfortable with as a ratio, not as a balance to keep, you know, and it's not on employers to set that. It's for the individual.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Aki, what do you think of that idea where we try to find our own individual work-life ratios?
I think the difficult thing with that is that, you know, we're social creatures and we're incredibly vulnerable, for example, to peer pressure. Let's say you're a brand new employee, you're 23 years old at a new company, you have very few skills. It's really hard for you to push back against your manager who's telling you to work on a Saturday or a Sunday. I think that's why it's important to have collective rules to protect especially these vulnerable workers from overworking. Certainly, we all have different personal preferences, but I do think there's a lot of value in setting a collective limit the way that Europe does.
Thanks for that call, Aki. In our last less than a minute now, what are you watching for in the future after, you know, so many people are leaving their jobs, as you said, reevaluating their jobs? What are you watching for to change?
I'd like to see how this all settles down in the pandemic. Right now, we have this extraordinary situation where there's so many different factors at play. It's hard to figure out what's going on. Will Americans really continue to want to work less once things go back to normal 2-3 years down the road? That's what I'm going to be looking for, to see if this is actually a lasting change or if this ends up just being a pandemic blip.
Aki, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, covering the economy, the labor, and workplace. Check out Aki's latest piece, How Hustle Culture Got America Addicted to Work. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The HBO show Euphoria is in its second season. The popular show receives mixed reviews for its heavy portrayal of teenage drug use. Euphoria stars Zendaya, whose character swings between overdose, recovery, and relapse. Dope Sick, Everything Must Go, and Clean and Sober are a handful of the many other shows and movies centered around addiction. People with substance abuse disorders have been on the big and small screen for years. What do movies and TV shows get right and wrong when it comes to drugs and addiction? What effect does it have on viewers? Zhao Zha Cao is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. Zhao Zha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob. I've been a big fan of public radio.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, what kind of effect does it have when people see drugs and addiction on the big and small screen? Does this influence what people think about drugs?
It does. It's especially impactful among young people. It all depends on how drug use are portrayed on media. For example, if the drug use is associated with some desirable outcomes on media, for example, if young viewer see that attractive character has fun with friends experimenting drugs at a party, they are more likely to model the behavior because it suggests that such behavior is a reward.
Our connection is breaking up a little bit, Zhao Zhao. A producer will give you a quick call. I'll say again, we're talking to Zhao Zhao Cao, associate professor at the UW-Milwaukee Department of Communication. We're going to be talking more about the impact of how TV shows and movies, how the media portrays fictional characters using drugs, addiction, and treatment. And I'll remind you that it's our Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Member Drive. While we reconnect, you can support great conversations like this one with a gift right now on this last day of the drive at WPR.org. That's WPR.org. You can also call and give at 888-202-2552. Last chance to give during this drive, a t-shirt available to you if you give $12 a month or more. Think about all the great conversations you count on here on the Ideas Network. What does it mean to you? How many conversations have you started with something you've heard here on the Ideas Network? Make a gift right now. Put a dollar value on it, an amount that's comfortable for you. Give at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. $10 a month is a common amount that people will give during these drives. The last day of this winter member drive, waiting to reconnect to our guest right now. Okay, we've got Zhao Zhao, we have you back, I think. Thanks for reconnecting with us.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. These things
are internet problem.
That's part of the fun of live radio. Now, you were just talking about how the importance of looking at how drugs and addiction and treatment are portrayed. Now, when you look at what you see in the media, how are people struggling with substance abuse disorders? How do we often see them portrayed in our shows and movies?
Well, for the most part, you know, movies, music even, and TV dramas do portray drug use, but for the most part, such a portrayal doesn't really show long-term or short-term consequences of such drug use, so let alone portray negative impact. Without such portrayal, you know, viewers, especially young viewers, are more likely to model such behavior. Also, if the media portray drug use in a positive way, for example, they show drug use is part of a party scene and attractive characters have a good time experimenting drugs with their friends at the parties, they are more likely to model such behavior because drug use in this case associated with a positive thing that they want to get through using drugs.
I know one concern is what you were just talking about, kind of glamorizing drug use. Often, though, we see it associated with criminal behavior, criminalizing drug use, or sometimes we see medical consequences. Does it matter when we see negative consequences of drug use? Does it matter how they're portrayed in those ways?
Sure, certainly. You know, it all depends on, you know, the plot of the stories or also who are the person that being portrayed in the plot or even in media coverage. For example, there's a study showing that when media portray drug use problem in non-white communities, for example, urban areas that normally predominantly, you know, non-white communities, the media tend to associate with the drug use with criminal act. They will often report, include a shorter report of arrest. In there, they're talking about the charge that issued, the amount of drug issued and seized or, you know, the name of the people that involved. These stories usually do not include any information about these people. In other words, their personal stories, why they use drugs, and the kind of impact the drug use among their families, among their communities, on their communities. But this type of portrayal have a dehumanized impact on the drug addicts, non-white drug addicts.
because without knowing more about this individual, people tend to have less sympathetic view about them and less likely to support interventions that help them. This is mainly, you know, affect media portrayal of non-white drug users. But when it comes to white drug users, media tend to provide more sympathetic portrayal. For example, they tend to provide detailed explanations of why these people use drugs, why the drug addicts, you know, use drugs. They often say, oh, they are talented students or young people. They happen to start using prescriptions of their parents or grandparents, or they've been great students, but they fell in with a wrong crowd, or they suffer an injury or surgery, they're prescribed with prescription opioids, they become addictive to it. By providing these type of explanations, it kind of has their problem explained to the audience and make these people seem like victim and they should be blamed for their problem. So that's kind of, you know, different portrayal can have different impact.
You also, I understand, look at anti-drug use campaigns. So kids might see drugs, not just in movies and TV shows, but in actual anti-drug messages. What do we know about how effective those are?
Well, those, you know, there's really, most of them, you know, are not very effective, but there are some of them are effective. So there's a study, look at 12 anti-drug campaigns and find that two of them actually, you know, reduce the drug use among the target audience. Four of them have a counterproductive effect. In other words, boomerang effects. They actually increase drug use. And eight of them have no effects at all. Most of these anti-drug campaigns target toward young people. But young people really at age that really desire freedom and independence, and they have a tendency to disavow authorities. Many drug campaigns to young people is really like a lecture from authority. Tell them, don't use drugs or you will suffer this or that. They don't really like them. So that they kind, for them, using drug is actually an attractive way to attractive way of a rebellion to authority. So also these drug campaigns sometimes make young people aware of some of the drugs they have never heard of. So really spark curiosity among them. So motivate them to try these drugs. And a third reason that many of these anti-drug campaigns are not really effective is that it creates the misperception that drug use is a norm, because young people really try to figure out the social norms, you know, what's going on in the world through media. So when they were hammered with anti-drug campaign talking about not using drugs, it actually created unintended effects of, you know, make the young people think that, oh, everybody around me are using drugs, or otherwise, why they keep telling us not using drugs. But I don't see, you know, most of my friends, you know, suffer from anything. Maybe, you know, I should go try it. Some kind of that thoughts going on in young people's head. So make them more likely to follow the norms and start using drugs. So effective anti-drug strategy have been that really, you know, telling young people that not using drugs is actually exemplify a freedom and the independence of external influence. For example, there's this very successful anti-drug campaign called Above Influence, which is call for young people to join the movement, empower young people to recognize and face the influence around them, including the pressure of use drugs.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to our guest, Zhaojia Cao, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. We talked today about how substance abuse is portrayed in the media, what it means for viewers, and how to craft more effective anti-drug campaigns for younger viewers.